top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
If you think you know what happened...
Two moms disappear from the same playground.
You're wrong.
I want to know what you've done with Amy!
If you think you know who did it...
It was Nazi!
Stop that! Stop that! Stop it!
Think again.
Tell them he died!
If you think it's only a nightmare...
First dream.
Keep dreaming.
I know what you're going to do!
From Brian De Palma. Raising Kane. Rated R.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 262, Brian De Palma's Raising Kane, and I'm reminded of When a Stranger Calls. Have you checked the children? Where are these children? Where are the children disappearing to? Raising Kane, a psychological thriller, which again is right up our alley because we love these psychological little dramas. And this was a fun one that I'm glad you suggested because I countered with a different De Palma.
You did,
this is
you
our
did.
First foray into BD.
Well, it semi,
BDP.
I mean, BDP, exactly. Not BEP, right? Not Black. We talk too much about the Black Eyed Peas in this podcast. Something...
Proportionally, considering their influence on the horror genre, yes.
Exactly. And speaking of artists that have a lot of influence on the horror genre, this is not Run DMC and their seminal record, Raising Hell. That was a record by Run DMC.
I think so, yeah.
I think so.
Tougher Than Leather, was that them too? Or was it... I don't even know.
I was saying Tougher Than the Rest, but that's a Bruce Springsteen song. But no, this is... BDP, Brian De Palma, and you mentioned the movie, which was Prime De Palma, right? And I'm not going to say what movie it is, because we might get to it one of these days.
Okay.
Yes, it's the first De Palma movie that we're discussing wholeheartedly. Way back when we first began this podcast, it could have been in our first dozen episodes, we did an episode talking about low-budget movies, not necessarily horror movies, but low-budget movies that really, really had a formative effect on us. And I spent some time talking about Phantom of the Paradise. I made a huge gaffe. I remember that when I said that Paul Williams is no longer with us when he's very much alive. It was actually William Finley that had passed away.
Okay.
And, you know, but we're human. We make mistakes. And so this is BDP not quite in his prime. His prime was the 70s, 80s. This is 90s BDP. This is when... Unfortunately, all great filmmakers, they seem to sort of have their ascent, their peak. Sometimes they have a bit of a descent, sometimes a rebirth. This one, you can argue that it was on his descent, but on the other hand, there's enough in it to commend it. And so while this may not be, you know, your sisters or your Carrie or Dressed to Kill or your body doubles, even your Scarfaces, there's a lot to commend about this movie.
For sure, and I didn't bring it up pre-discussion, but it'd be interesting to see if we even saw the same version, because it shouldn't affect how the main themes. But I saw I guess IndieWire wrote up a big spiel about how they recut this after some would say a fairly muddled initial release of this film, which had so many debits that people, I guess, had issues following it, and it is infused with all sorts of weird Lifetime movie kind of melodrama, and then they recut it. That really brings the plot twist, I would say, to the forefront. So I saw the recut version.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's just... chronology, but we don't really need to delve too much. But so what did you see then?
I saw the non-recut version. I saw the original version, and I did not find out about this recut version until afterwards when I was doing my crack research. Because the narrative is very convoluted, and the way this movie starts was not the way De Palma intended it to start. He intended the second, I guess you would say, arc of the story to begin the movie. Right? And yes, when this movie came out, it didn't, it wasn't a massive flop. I mean, on a $12 million budget, it made $21 million, but it, you know, was definitely didn't light the boxes on fire, nor did it really get anything massive in the way of critical acclaim. Many years later, actually, a fan was the one who took that and recut it.
Oh, okay.
Made a fan cut of it. Huh. And when De Palma saw it, because, I mean, he's like, well, this is the way I wanted the movie to be originally, he took that fan cut and put a stamp of approval on it, so it became the official director's cut. So when this movie was re-released on Blu-ray by Shout Factory, you had the option of watching either cut. Now, it's just very interesting, because I cannot think of any other movie where a fan cut, a fan edit, becomes the official director's cut.
No, it's impossible, and it's so funny that he would be so receptive to it that he would be the one actually saying, this is more adhering to my initial vision. I mean, I would say that's impossible. Ridiculous and insane, and then it made it its way into the Blu-ray, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure where I sit with this one, because I'm sort of lukewarm to De Palma. I mean, at his highs, I guess Untouchables, I would say, okay, which yep. I thought was fantastic, with obviously Sean Connery. And Scarface, it never resonated with me. There's a certain, I mean, just, I admit I haven't seen the original, but it has cheesiness to it that I just can't get past. Like, it's so, especially compared with other gangster movies, like I revisited, whether you even, let's say, Once Upon a Time in America, or let's say Goodfellas, like, they're so superior in the gangster front. Mm-hmm. And that one is just like, oh, it's just Pacino at his, like, maybe not at his worst, because that was
none. Friend who actually thinks that's Al Pacino's greatest performance, bar none. It's interesting. I mean, this is not a Scarface podcast. This is our Raising Kane podcast. But one thing I remember, when Scarface came out, it wasn't the immediate cultural milestone that it is now. It was met with a lot of disdain, I believe, critically and commercially. The ultra-violence definitely turned off a lot of critics, etc. The excesses, the swearing. I think I read somewhere that there's more utterances of the F-word in Scarface than any other movie in history.
Excellent, huh?
It's really only as time went on and people started rediscovering Scarface, and then when it got adopted by hip-hop culture.
Yeah, and I would say the poster went a long way to fuel that fire as well. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, and I don't even care so much about the affectations in the Hitchcockian business. I think that's a little, it hasn't really bothered me with Tarantino. Anyone who adopts other people's style, I don't care that much. It's just his movies are just hit and miss to me, and I'm not sure. Body Double, I don't know.
I'm like a big fan. I mean, what about Blowout with Travolta? That's,
I have not seen that one. Oh, God.
Something for the future.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a big fan of early De Palma. I would say The Untouchables in 87 was his peak as a commercial director. 2 years later, he released a movie called Casualties of War with Michael J. Fox, Sean Penn.
Yeah.
Didn't do very well. It was a dramatic role for Michael J. Fox. To be honest with you, I tried watching it. Couldn't get through it. After that, in 1990, this is when his sort of, I want to say annus horribilis, I don't even know, but it's not a year, it's a decade, right? Put out an adaptation of Bonfire of the Vanities, which was a huge flop.
Yeah, Bonfire of the Vanities, right, yeah.
I mean, some of the principals were able to get out of it unscathed. Tom Hanks, Bruce Willis, Melanie Griffith. Well, her career has been faltering ever since. Yeah,
was that the Gore Vidal or Tom Wolfe?
Tom Wolfe.
Yeah.
But yeah, after that, he had to retreat. And so what did he do? He retreated back to the genre he knows so well, which is thriller and suspense. And that brought... before we got Raising Kane, we got Carlito's Way. And I will argue that is way better than Scarface.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't remember too much about it, but the same could be said about the former as well. So, yeah.
From a narrative perspective, from a performance perspective, by Sean Penn and Al Pacino, etc. But then now here we are in 1992 and Raising Kane with John Lithgow.
John Lithgow. It's interesting seeing him in this role because obviously Trinity from Dexter, who really, I guess, gave that show a shot in the arm, like, tremendously. It was beginning to sag when he came in, and then,
well, it was the third season, and that was the greatest season.
Yeah,
the first season was Cracker Jack. The second season was lackluster. Remember that with the Jimmy Smits character? That was pretty bad, man.
Oh my god,
Jimmy Smits is your, well, I guess spoiler alert, your main antagonist. You got some. a few problems.
But good for him for working as much as he does.
Who would have thought? This LA Law alum. I mean, Harry Hamlin doesn't work as much as Jimmy Smith. Susan Day. How do I even know this? I never watched LA Law. Not even one episode in my life.
Oh, my God. And then, and then playing the confidant and almost the consigliere to Jax Teller in the biker show, their Sons of Anarchy. I mean, the guy was great. Although I did read that his toupee flew off during one of the scenes. I don't know if that's true or not, but I like to think it's true because that's hilarious. And speaking of toupees, I guess, you have John Lithgow here as the antagonist who's, I mean, got that steely determination. He's great, and what a range. I mean, mm-hmm. I was never a fan of Third Rock from the Sun.
Nor was I.
But I think if any show was really carried by personalities, it would be that one, because it wasn't particularly well written, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt's pretty phenomenal. He's amazing. But just put two of them in it and you could almost have nothing written and you'd watch. But mm-hmm. it was always like, what is this stuff? Oh, it's income tax. It's a thing you got to do for the government. Oh, I don't understand that. I'm an alien.
Stewart. How did I know this? I never watched that show.
I watched it more than I really should have, but it was every kind of... It was just such a cheap fish out of water play that it was just. But that guy, he came across my radar. You can't take your eyes off him. He's phenomenal.
Getting back to John Lithgow, I just want to talk just a wee bit more about his stint on Dexter, because I think we talked about it a few weeks ago when we did our You podcast. But I just want to say that was the greatest season. He played the most terrifying, the most cunning, the most evenly matched, let's say, to Dexter villain in the entire history of that series. And the denouement, the climax of that season, was unbelievable. And I wish it would have ended it then. Because it was all downhill. John Lithgow is somebody who is, I guess the word I'm going to describe him as, and this is a compliment. It may not sound like a compliment, but it totally is. Very dependable. Every time you see John Lithgow in a movie, you know that you're going to get quality from him. And he's got such a range. And a lot of that is actually showcased in this movie. In Dexter, he was reprehensible. In other movies, he's comedic. Sure, in Third Rock, he was lovable because he was the befuddled fish.
Definitely.
Yeah.
The befuddled academic. And he's got the Gene Hackman, you can never blame him factor, as I call it. Like, he's in something. Maybe it's a train wreck. You can never blame him. He pulls his weight constantly. And here, this is pretty funny because he's playing multiple characters, I guess, to befit his multiplicity of abilities. Because he's playing, five or six different personalities. Multiple personalities.
Five characters.
Okay.
I have them all written down.
Should we go through them?
Well, that's the whole thing. Yeah. I don't know if I should, because I don't want to spoil things, you know? But so we're going to be... Because one thing I want to say is, I mean, I guess it's not really spoiling things, because I knew this even when I saw the trailers back in the day, even when I saw the poster back in the day in 1992, I knew that this was a movie about multiple personalities. Mm-hmm. So we're not spoiling it. I think the marketing did so all those years ago. But in a lot of ways, I mean, M. Night Shyamalan and James McAvoy got a lot of credit for the movie Split. And Split was a good movie. Definitely a return to form for M. Night Shyamalan. I haven't seen Glass. Although I really do want to see it, because I love, The Untouchables, but I love Unbreakable. And of course, Glass is a de facto sequel to both Split and Unbreakable, but the reviews have been quite tepid, so I'm probably going to wait for that one to... Let's say I'm not running to the theater to see it, but I will see it. But this movie, in many ways, was Split before Split. James McAvoy was phenomenal in Split, playing all those different characters, more than Lithgow did in this one. And again, I mean, it's the trappings of the genre. I feel that McAvoy should have been nominated for an Oscar for Split, just like I feel Toni Collette should have been nominated for an Oscar for her unbelievable performance in Hereditary. I can't think of a better female performance of the past year, but of course, horror movies don't get Oscar nominations. No. James McAvoy should have been nominated. Toni Collette should have been nominated. Lithgow, I'm not saying he should have been nominated, but it was a good, meaty role for him, and it was a good performance.
Yeah, and as cheesy as this was at times, you couldn't picture anyone else really doing any better. So if you put someone of less caliber, what could they have possibly done? He made the most of maybe something that was a threadbare idea that wasn't fully fleshed out, although it has a lot of positives. So when I said in the intro, check the children, and where are the children?
At first, I was a little confused.
Yeah, it's like, because this is all about, let's say, some nefarious wannabe Skinner Piaget psychologist who's doing these experiments on kids that they don't really allude to, but they know he's up to no good because the kids are not consenting to participating in these experiments.
Well, I mean, they're not going there voluntarily.
Yeah, like, and that their parents are not involved. Yeah. So obviously, you can only hope that these experiments only involve something innocuous, but you don't know. And that's to its credit. That's kind of interesting. He's doing something, but you don't know what the something is. Mm-hmm. And against this is a backdrop of this family drama and infidelities that's going on around Valentine's Day, which is great. But these sort of subplots thrown together made for kind of... I was interested in both facets of the machinations of what was going on with his wife, mm-hmm. as well as the kidnapping. It sort of... It was really good. I thought he played these two hands very effectively, and I didn't expect that at all for a thriller.
It's true. You mentioned we don't quite know exactly what he's doing with these kids, although there is a really, really entertaining character by the name of Dr. Waldheim, who is somebody who, let's just say...
She had like a bad psychoanalyst accent, the Dr. Ruth Westheimer, that
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of that, yeah. And yeah, I mean, she knows the family, the Nix family, right?
Yeah.
Lithgow, I mean, the main character he's playing is Dr. Carter Nix. And I say the main character because that's the dominant personality that we're supposed to be rooting for throughout the movie. Of course, Kane is another facet of his personality. Dr. Waldheim does, they bring her in for some investigation once they start to realize that, hey, you know what, instead of a victim, Nix may very well be a suspect. And she does, because she worked with Nix Sr. back in the day, and he was doing nefarious things with kids. And her suspicion, and I'm not going to say if it was correct or incorrect, is that... what the father was doing, the son is now carrying on. The son is carrying on the experiments of the father. The experiments are more, from what I gleaned from the conjecture, because again, nothing was fully explained, was that it was psychological, and he needed some sort of... There was some mention of like a control group or something, and that
Well, it makes sense if you could... If you're doing like a nature-nurture thing to extract someone... purely out of their home environment and manipulate all the variables within the confines of your lab. I mean, that would probably be a dream of some sicko doctor, right? Mm-hmm. You can do whatever the hell you want.
But ultimately, what the aim of these experiments were was to take kids and create multiple personalities within them, to actually somehow, through various stimuli, various trauma, what have you, to actually... And again, you talk about nature-nurture, you know? Like, is multiple personality disorder something from birth, or is it something that happens later on? They say that trauma in the movie, they're talking like great trauma can cause people to separate different facets of their personality and so on. But to actually willfully take a child whose mind is so malleable and try and inflict these traumas upon them so that then they become somebody suffering from multiple personality, that's pretty damn disturbing.
It is disturbing, but I guess if you look back in the annals of medical history, we shouldn't necessarily be surprised. Maybe it's the Tuskegee experiment that had African Americans unwittingly subjected to various pathogens. And so, yeah, I mean, and that's even going back 60 years. So
and I guess the MKUltra experiment.
Oh my God, you could go on. I mean, luckily they have, oversight boards to prevent some of this stuff. But let's just say this guy was going rogue, and his work wasn't under the auspices of any hospital or institute. And that I had to laugh with the patriarch. He's Norwegian or something.
You're talking about Dr. Carter Nix.
Yeah, he's pulling like this Max von Sydow like Scandinavian guy with glasses. I was just laughing. Like, he was so great as a character, and like almost schooling his I guess protege doctor, and he was just so great. And all these different people and all their lives kind of coming together, and I really, really dug the again the infidelity plot. Mm-hmm. It was hilarious.
Let's talk a little bit about the infidelity plot.
Well, I mean, just his gorgeous wife is not getting the attention from this weirdo at home.
Played who seems by Lolita Davidovich, that was very briefly an it girl in the 90s. She was in a movie called Blaze with Paul Newman. She played, I believe it was a biopic of the burlesque dancer Blaze Starr. This is just coming from my head.
Okay.
And she got a lot of media attention from that, and then other roles followed, and this was one. Because, I don't know, she's kind of fallen off the map since. But.
Well, that's too bad. Obviously, she's been estranged from her guy, who seems to be treating his own kids very clinically. So he's dealing with them in a very... Very hands-off kind of scientific ways. You almost get the sense that he's running through sort of proto-experiments on his own kids. So mm-hmm. she obviously strays and ends up with this dashing gent. Mm-hmm. Who, and that was the most hilarious way that they ended up. I mean, her lover was at the bedside of... his wife, who was dying of lung cancer, which I just found out.
She was the oncologist. Yeah, she was
talk about tacky. That has got to be the worst setup ever. If you are cheating with the surviving, soon to be widowed spouse of the person you're treating,
they were making out.
I couldn't believe that
at the bedside of the wife when she took her last breath. I mean, that's.
Oh, that was so audacious. Like, I gasped when I saw that. When she, jumped out of bed in fright. I guess she had some sort of sixth sense of what was going on. Speaking of M. Night, of what was going on with her cheating. What politician was that who was cheating on his spouse while she was pregnant? I don't know. This is, beyond
every
that.
Politician?
Yeah, maybe. I forget. But this
was
even,
it the 80s?
I forget, but this is worse. I mean, how could you be so cold and ruthless? And so that immediately sets up all sorts of notions of how her kind of... relatability, but by the same token, you're setting it into a tailspin of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And
it should be noted also that her lover, the one that is cuckolding Dr. Nix,
Junior,
is played by Stephen Bauer, he was in Scarface. I think he was in another De Palma movie. I can't recall the moment, but lately, we've been seeing him a lot in Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. He has a recurring role, mostly in flashbacks, as Don Eladio. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, he's
nice.
A few things here and there.
And he's really only there to be a patsy kind of fall guy. But still, like, it works.
We need a patsy. I'm looking for a patsy. Right here. Oh. Can you not see I'm looking for a patsy? Simpsons reference. Yeah. Gotta do it.
Oh,
certain
my God.
Words I hear, they just trigger. They trigger. That's a trigger word for me. You should have said trigger
word.
Oh, I alert.
Love it. Well, man, I'm starting, like, as we talk this out, I'm starting to really enjoy this movie more and more because, at the outset, I was getting a very Melrose Place Lifetime movie vibe, but I was buying into all the cheesy romance 90s excesses. I was loving it.
Well, one thing I got to say, and... because this was to the film's debit, because I watched it in its theatrical cut. So I watched the movie shift from Carr's point of view kind of abruptly to his wife's point of view. And that was done in a very weird way, like a voiceover sort of flashback type thing, which to me felt very soap opera-y. It felt very cheesy. I didn't like it. But it wasn't enough for me to dismiss the entire movie. I'm wondering what the effect of that would have been if that was, boom, right there at the very beginning of the film.
Well, yeah, it's weird. Like, cart before horse. What do you do in a movie about a guy's mental disintegration who's a scientist and a detached... like, if you launch with a woman and her marital problems with him, does it make it better that he would potentially snap? Or is... yeah, I think it definitely... to introduce her later makes more thematic sense. Because... yeah, because I'm thinking about an average viewer in 1992, 93, just wading through this stuff going, okay, when am I going to get to this psychological meltdown? When am I going to get into the snake pit kind of psycho, multiple personality thing?
And that's the thing, too, because, I mean, because we have this narrative, or at least what I experienced, I shifted from one perspective very abruptly to somebody else's perspective, and both of them, both Carter and his wife, I believe her name am I correct in saying Jenny?
Jenny, yeah.
Both of them are unreliable narrators.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, I mean, Carter by way of his multiple personality disorder, and Jenny by way of all these different visions that she's having and dreams within dreams. It's like a Russian nesting doll of dreams.
That was interesting. Was kind it of threw me for a loop, that's for sure.
So you really don't know what's truth and what's fiction. You really don't know who to grasp onto in terms of this is the narrative. So you're watching this and you cannot really believe what we're being presented from the perspective of Dr. Nix, nor can we believe what's really being presented from his wife. We just have to watch it as it plays out and sort of suss things out as the film progresses, which is quite interesting as far as the narrative goes.
Yeah, and I think also this harkens back to a style of filmmaking that's since passed. And I was thinking about from that period, you had your maybe, oh, what's that James Spader thing? It'll come to me. From that time, I was thinking maybe...
Jack's Back,
maybe Dead Calm. One of these types of thrillers, it doesn't have this convoluted backstory and twists and turns. Like, this has Hitchcockian elements.
Oh, for sure.
And I really appreciate that style of filmmaking, because most thrillers are straight ahead. Like, either... hell, even When a Stranger Calls is more of a thriller, and it's more procedural. It's more, you know, there's nothing that really jumps out at you. This is playing with your expectations like nobody's business. Mm-hmm. And you could call it maybe incoherent, but I think the recut does it a lot of favors. And you don't really, I mean, the first victim, I did not see that coming at all. And how she's dealt with is very dexterously handled. Oh, but that was so cool because appears.
Were you making a pun, like as in Dexter?
Yeah, well, both. Okay. But it was like Dexter. This like victim that. Appears yeah. and yeah. then boom, like she, I would have thought she would have had more impact because she really has a lot to do with kids. And then she disappears, and this is not spoiling it at all, but she propels the narrative forward in ways that I did not anticipate. And that incident drives the entire plot. I mean, mm-hmm. that was amazing.
And it's interesting you said, you mentioned the Hitchcockian elements, because when Brian De Palma first burst on the scene, when he started getting a lot of notoriety, it was both positive and negative, and most of the criticism was that he was ripping off Hitchcock. He was ripping off the master of suspense. De Palma was... unabashed Hitchcock fan, but there was definitely a bit of a testy relationship there, because Hitch was still alive at the time and he was not happy about this young upstart that was using a lot of his tricks and so on. And when Alfred passed on, that's when De Palma sort of abandoned making the Hitchcockian movies. I mean, there's nothing Hitchcockian about Scarface, right? Now, of course, I said to you that he had to retreat after that massive flop, The Bonfire of the Vanities, so then he went back and started incorporating some Hitchcockian elements into Raising Kane. It was him going back to his comfort zone, and once again, not as successful as his earlier attempts at making Hitchcockian thrillers, but an interesting semi-return to form that definitely had a lot to commend about it.
So if you had to take one director, it's not even a Mary fuck kill or anything. There's only two.
Yep.
It's Wes Craven versus De Palma. You've not been shy in your antipathy towards Wes Craven.
Nor have you, but, really.
But no, but mm-hmm. you give credit where credit is due. When you have Last House on the Left and Nightmare and these kinds of films, like him at his best, he's got, let's say, three or four dynamite movies. I even like The Serpent and the Rainbow. I thought it was a riot. Both of them have similar career trajectories of making garbage later after their peak. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe, like, who has more ability? I would say De Palma.
I would say De Palma 100%. And,
But I even warmed to Red Eye. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm starting to come around to... that was as, I think, De Palma-esque as Craven has ever been. And that's a straight-ahead thriller. Who knows?
Well,
but this... I mean,
I used to like De Palma. Now I admire him tremendously, and that's because of a documentary that came out, I believe, in 2015 called De Palma. And it was basically Brian De Palma as a talking head going chronologically through his career from the beginning to the end, and they would intersperse it with various clips from his movies. And one thing I learned was that De Palma was a true maverick. I mean, this was a man that was willing to put everything on the line for every movie he made. He was willing to put his career on the line. He was willing to put his personal finances on the line. He would, I mean, my mind cannot remember all the details, but there were things he was doing to prepare for movies. Like, he would put himself in actual physical danger, maybe riding along with certain people. I don't remember. But Brian De Palma comes from that school, you know, I think from the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, etc. Those great filmmakers that started emerging in the late 60s and the 70s, who really sort of revolutionized cinema for time immemorial since. And there were many of them were absolute mavericks, and one of those was certainly Brian De Palma. So, I mean, the respect I have for the man is massive. And as far as the film output goes, comparing, let's say, a lesser Craven to lesser De Palma, I would go with De Palma. Mind you, I've yet to see Mission to Mars, which apparently is in the Nadir. And then last week I mentioned to somebody, mentioned to me, have you ever seen Mission to Mars? I said, no, but I really want to see it. And they just said, don't. That was all I heard.
Hey, we made no secret of our love of Battlefield Earth.
I think
so. I'm ready to launch to the Red Planet. I mean, whenever you are, just let me know.
Let's do. I mean, we can't do about the Palma movie next week, but I think, yeah, you know, down the road,
down
we
the road,
have to do Mission to Mars.
So, should we get to the point in the podcast where we discuss what we've learned?
I think it's appropriate.
Okay, friend of the show, Scott Drebbit, fellow writer from Daily Dead, a big fan of Greg Henry. And here, Greg Henry from Slither, who is this awesome character here, is one of the cops working the case of the missing children / missing woman. And there's some wonderful business involving him and trying to piece all these things together. There's also some very interesting bits involving cars, most notably the sinking of a car a la Psycho, and also a great line. I don't know if you wrote this one down.
Probably not, but let's see.
It's not the mileage, it's the make. I thought that was a terrific line. So, yeah, a couple of things I learned. What did you learn?
Not so much what did I learn, but another thing I thought was quite interesting was when Dr. Nix is made aware, he finds out about his wife's infidelity, and when the police are investigating these rashes of child
abductions yeah,
within the neighborhood, they asked Dr. Nix to work with a sketch artist and to provide,
yes,
you know,
exactly. So that was very funny.
What
yeah.
he did, it was completely amusing, completely just fantastic. I loved it.
Star rating.
You know, it's funny because I was thinking of giving this movie 3 stars. But as we're talking about it, I'm realizing that there's more to appreciate. You know, it deserves an extra half star just for Lithgow's performance. I mean, you could tell he was having the time of his life, yeah. chewing the scenery as various yeah. characters. Some were, of course, more meek than others, but when he was playing, for example, the manifestation Kane, he was a cool guy. yeah. Oh, another thing I did learn, there were small giallo elements, and that's another thing that, mm-hmm. you know, every so often, I mean, at one point, a murder is committed, a black glove is donned. yeah. Every time you see a black glove killer, you think about giallo. So, 3.5 stars for me. And frankly, I do want to revisit it, but watching the quote-unquote director's cut, because I want to see it from the other perspective and see how the film would impact me when you take 2 large chunks and transpose them. And that's pretty much what the director's cut is, right?
But I'd be remiss without adding another little tidbit to what I learned as as a longtime 90210 fan. One of the flings, let's say, is played by Gabriel Carteris.
Right.
Who was like, supposed to be Andrea, which is
yes,
like one of the most terrible
yes.
names in all of television history.
Just, I know.
It's so overbearing.
Like, I mean, let's put it this way. I'm sure in your life you've met many an Andrea.
Yes.
You've probably met 1 or 2, right?
I have more than met a couple.
It's this common name. Have you mm-hmm. ever met anybody who is Andrea?
It's almost like, yeah, an Andrew or something.
Exactly. Andrew knows I'm Andrew. And when they, because I forgot we mentioned that, right? She plays a babysitter in this movie. I'm thinking back to her time in 90210. We always joked that all the actors were long in the tooth to play high school students.
Yeah.
She was the longest in the tooth.
She must have been like 36.
She was 10 years senior than every other cast member, and they're all in their mid-20s playing high school students. She was in her 30s, so little Andrea.
Oh, my God. Well, you got to start somewhere. I'm going to give this 3.5, a solid 3.5. I just... I love the infidelity and the two-timing and the scheming, and the police work was so fantastically handled. One of them actually said toward the end, as they're piecing the different parts of the puzzle together, this is, quote, a detective's dream, like this case, because it's fascinating, and it holds together pretty well. So I would recommend you watch the recut, and this is something I might even consider buying. Like, I'm a big fan. Who would have thought? And hopefully you're a fan of our podcast and you enjoyed yesterday's special, the Valentine's Day little bonus coverage, and support the show by picking up a copy of Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. It would really help us out, help us finance things. You'll really enjoy it if you're into horror kills and slasher movies from the golden era of the 80s all the way to today. You're going to love it.
And available on all Amazons.
Yes, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.